Welcome to Sprouts Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience produced at a different location each week. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, your host for Spirit in Action, broadcast via WHYS LP in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. This is a Northern Spirit radio production, lifting up the work and lives aimed at healing the world through peace, justice, compassion, and care for creation. Today on Sprouts, we'll be sharing roughly half of an hour-long Spirit in Action interview with Ruis Wennerfelt and Steve Chase on the Transition Town movement, changing our world in how we deal with the environment from the bottom up.
Let us sing this song for the healing of the world, that we may heal as one. With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will feel the echo of our healing.
In early July, I sat down before a live audience at the University of Rhode Island in Kingston to talk to two longtime environmental activists whose recent focus has been the Transition Town movement. Ruis Wennerfelt has been a vital part of implementing the change in her Vermont town, Charlotte, with a population of about 4,000, while Steve Chase is thoroughly engaged in the same transformation, but in Keene, New Hampshire, a city of 25,000. They are also part of a new organization called Quakers in Transition. Steve Chase is Director of Advocacy for Social Justice and Sustainability at Antioch University, New England. Ruis Wennerfelt was the longtime secretary of Quaker Earth Care Witness. Ruis and Steve, welcome to Spirit in Action.
Thank you
so much. It's great to be here.
I'm really excited about the Quakers in Transition project. What is the motivation for this? I know both of you have environmental concerns. Why transition? What's the motivation behind this?
Well, because we need it. We're in a situation of what I consider a perfect storm of peak oil, climate change, and economic instability. They're all happening at once, and we have to do something. We could either kind of tear our hair out to go out and protest, hope that the government will make a difference, or we can take charge ourselves and do something. And that's what the Transition Town movement is about. It's about grassroots, about people making a difference where they live. It's about transitioning gracefully away from those fossil fuels and into a different, healthier world.
Yeah, on the website for the Keene Transition Movement, the town where I'm at, the website has a tagline, which is, for local people concerned about peak oil, climate change, and a dysfunctional and unjust global economy, who want to respond with vision, courage, and creativity. And I think for some people, it's hard to even think about this. Denial is so thick, and that sometimes it can be so painful to look at our situation in the world. On the other hand, despair doesn't seem to be a very useful way for people to think about the future or get creative. And so what I think is great about this international network of community-driven initiatives that are very participatory and are trying to involve people at the local scale to move beyond sort of oil dependency and business as usual to creating thriving, resilient communities. And so if you go online and you look up peak oil, put it in Google, you're going to find a lot of people who are just so doom and gloom. You know, and there's some reasons for that. But I also think that there's so much happening around the world where people are creatively thinking through what kind of world do they want to live in and how to move there. And they don't have to wait for permission or governments to act. And I see Rua here has got what's the transition movement. If you go internationally, nationally, or local transition movement websites, they have this thing called the cheerful disclaimer. Why don't you read that?
The cheerful disclaimer is, we truly don't know if this will work. Transition is a social experiment on a massive scale. What we are convinced of is this. If we wait for the governments, it will be too little, too late. If we act as individuals, it'll be too little. But if we act as communities, it might just be enough, just in time.
You know, I'm really intrigued by one thing that both of you have said, and it's in the disclaimer, and you spoke about it, Steve. You said it's not dependent on government. And sometimes it seems amazingly difficult to find issues on which people across the political spectrum could unite on. Specifically, I'm thinking of people like the Tea Party and liberals. They don't normally find a lot of common ground. But the idea that this is doing it extra governmental seems to me like it would be a hook where people could come into unity on that. Of course, you have to be sharing in belief that there's an ecological calamity coming, and I'm not sure if there's a wide consensus on that.
One of the things that makes this successful in a community, it is nonpartisan, and it is about building resilience in a community. So you don't need to use the sustainability word, buzzword. You don't need to say peak oil, but you can say, how do we make our community resilient in the face of rising oil prices, climate catastrophes like Hurricane Irene when it came to Vermont, or economic instability, which we know exists? We can get nodding heads. I want my community to be resilient. Yes, this is something I'm willing to work on with you, even if we think the causes of those problems are different. And so you can come to the table with somebody who voted differently than you do and say, let's work together as partners.
Does it work out that way? Does it actually happen?
I think so. The one thing, it's not partisan in a political sense, but there is a question of some core values that I think are really important, because a person could agree that peak oil and the potential of energy famines are a growing and potentially catastrophic, economically catastrophic. People can agree that climate change is real, but how people respond to it also depends a lot on certain values that we hold. Because one way is, oh, well, we are going to go and take over the oil supplies of other people and get very competitive. And so for Quakers and many people of faith, the idea of energy famine raises the prospect even more of resource wars and having roots in wars. And so the alternative view of what my grandmother always taught me, which is, well, you know, people have to learn to get along and they have to learn how to share. Somebody once said, the future, if there is one, will include sharing, because we could have a war of all against all. One of the things that's true for transition, and it emerged out of one of the key players, was this guy named Rob Hopkins. And he was a permaculture teacher. And permaculture has three core values. One is earth care. The second one is people care. And then the third one is fair share. It's not just that we have these severe challenges that we have to address, but how we address this depends a lot on the view of, well, do we want business as usual in terms of certain kinds of hierarchies, violence, or do we want to create local democracy, a real sense of kinship and we're in this together versus every person for themselves sort of thing. So I agree with Rua that it's nonpartisan, but it's not that it doesn't have some core values that are really important. And where this came clear to me is, so I was looking on Transition US's website, which is sort of the national hub that helps support local community. And I also was looking at the Transition Network, which is the international hub. And they described a situation that in Europe, there was a group of neo-Nazis that took the name Transition Some Community. And they were using it as a way to say, well, you know, there's going to be certain levels of austerity and we have to learn to live on less, and therefore we have to do everything in our power to keep immigrants out of. And then they had the typical racist rhetoric that neo-Nazis have. And so that made it very clear to transition movement of that we really have to articulate our values. So now, if you go to Transition US's website and you look at various constitutions, in them will be things like, we support earth care, people care, fair share. We support the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And some of them say, when we support the Earth Charter.
What makes the transition movement successful is that it is a leaderless movement. There are people who give us inspiration. There are books and all of that. But none of those people who wrote those are leaders. This is a shared leadership. So the purpose that I see, the reason I started it in my community, is because I wanted to broaden the reach of people knowing people, understanding the resources that we've got. How can we share those resources with each other, and how will they help us in the transition? And how can we have fun together? That's like a really core principle, is having fun. We must have fun together. You're not going to invite people in to have more long, dreary meetings about what we're going to do, but we're going to have fun together.
Is it just that we've passed peak oil? Is that the only reason that we have to get hot on the track of transition, or is there some other timing that's really important? Why do we have to hurry so much?
We are in a situation of, I don't think of it as doom and gloom. You know, in permaculture, the solution is in the problem. The problem is the solution. So you have to fit the solution to the problem. It's kind of a joint thing. Well, of course, if there were no problems in the world, we probably wouldn't be thinking about this. But every time I get in my car, and I still own a car, I'm so aware that I am spewing CO2 into the atmosphere, that I'm helping cause more global warming, that pretty soon the parts per million of carbon dioxide in the air is not going to support the world anymore. Okay, enough doom and gloom. However, if I don't want to drive that car anymore, maybe I can help work on some local transportation that will allow me to bike to some bus close by, a little bus van that would take me to the bus that will take me to Burlington or something like that, because I live in the country. I see it as an opportunity.
So how is it actually different than being environmentally or ecologically conscious and, you know, having a program for that? How is it different from that? Is transition just the new name for the environmental movement?
Well, in some sense, that's true in that, you know, if you look at sort of the origin story of the transition movement, it often puts it at around 2005. But there have been so many things going on and different learnings and social learnings around the world that are sort of built into this. But I think something that's, if not unique, it is rare, which is, sure, we're facing huge challenges and not flinching from naming the challenges. But at the same time saying our response, I mean, it's good to live in challenging times. It's good to rise to the occasion. And for faith communities, the notion of right relationship that Rua was talking about, I facilitated a community conversation in Keene that had about 60 people from six different congregations. And I think we called it Climate, Faith, and Action. But there was a core concern that was pretty clear that I just sort of tried to articulate. Is I asked people in the room, how many people in your deepest heart of hearts want to live in a world that's spiritually fulfilling, socially just, and environmentally sustainable? And everybody's hands went up. And it's not just a mistake. It has so much to do with the roots of our faith tradition. If you look at page 2 of George Fox's journal, who's the founder of Quakerism, he talks about the three main kinds of loving that Judaism and Christianity have always taught and that are really important to Quakers. One is loving God with all one's heart and soul and strength. And that, I think, is one way to talk about spiritual fulfillment. Talks about loving your neighbors, including your enemies. And I think that has to do with social justice. And then written in the 1600s, it was saying we have to love God's good earth and act in unity with creation. So I think these concerns are really deep in many people's heart and certainly deep in faith traditions. And these kinds of pressures and challenges allows us to give up complacency, to give up conformity and get creative with our neighbors. And some examples of people doing things, even though they would disagree about whether gay marriage ought to be in place, even if they would disagree about who you would vote for, is in Keene, where we just about 3 weeks ago had a groundbreaking for a new food co-op. And it already has 1,000 members in a town that's 25,000 people. It has a strong commitment to buying locally because over the last 10 years, we've gotten, I think, close to 20 community-supported agricultures right around our area. We now have a farmer's market. We now have a winter's farmer's market. And part of transition is just thinking, well, what's kind of the next cool thing that we could do that would shift us to sort of responsible, safe, and green energy sources? And here's where it's different from a lot of environmentalists. With this sort of recognition, we're going to have to learn to live well on left, that all the alternatives, if you sort of do the math, and there's some dispute about this, but there's a really good chance that we're not going to have as ready a supply of cheap and abundant energy. And so what can, you know, all the stuff around local food in our committees, and that's really strong where Rui is in Vermont, is reducing food miles, reducing the inputs in terms of pesticides, which are petroleum-based, and fertilizers, petroleum-based, and the machinery. And so cutting down the food miles and creating that resilience, because I think the statistic is in a lot of major cities, if there weren't imports of food, there would be about 3 to 5 days supply before the people living in cities. And this is true of small towns, if the shelves of the supermarket wouldn't fill. And so having increasing the percentage that you're producing locally or regionally allows you to absorb the shocks that may be coming. And ecologically, resilience is this capacity of a system to absorb shocks and keep its fundamental integrity together. And so I do think you're right that a lot of people who might disagree about all sorts of things love their town and would love to be, you know, engaged as a volunteer and have public life and the joy of it. And that's one of the real positives, is seeing just the excitement of people thinking, what next?
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and this is Spirit in Action, a Northern Spirit radio production originating from WHYS-LP, Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Today we're looking at the Transition Town Movement with Steve Chase, Social Justice and Sustainability Advocacy Director at Antioch University, New England, and with Rua Swennerfelt, perennial force behind Quaker Earth Care Witness, and with the Charlotte, Vermont Transition Town implementation. So over to you, Rua. Just how does one go about becoming a transition town? What do you do, and is it applicable to absolutely any city or town?
I think the transition model is totally adaptable. I went to Europe last year, and I went to 10 different countries and visited transition communities. I also went to the Transition France conference and a Transition UK conference. And everybody I interviewed, everybody I talked to, they did things a little differently in their community. They had the same core principles and beliefs. They had the transition handbook. They didn't do the steps in exactly the same order. They didn't do all the steps. They added some steps depending on where they live and what kind of culture they had, and were they urban, were they suburban, were they rural. There was Transition Paris, and you go, well, how can Paris be a neighborhood? Well, what they did was they broke down into smaller units that were each transition communities, and then they had a hub. So Paris was a hub, same in Transition Barcelona. I visited Transition Los Angeles. They do the same thing. So, you know, there are lots of physical manifestations of what people do. You know, we're talking a lot of words here. Well, what do they do? So an example, one transition community in England, they had their members during the summer stealthily going through neighborhoods and looking for where pear trees and apple trees and those sorts of things were, and they wrote down the addresses. And then when it was time for harvest, they went and rang the doorbell and said, we see that you've got a pear tree, you know, in your yard. If you're not going to collect all of it, we'd be happy to harvest the tree, give you what you want, and then we want to give the rest away to people in need. And I was like, wow, this is like kind of ultimate gleaning, right? You're helping the people that have the tree. And how many people have trees in their yards where the fruit falls and never gets eaten? What a waste. In our community, we have an asset directory. There's a survey. Anybody in the community can answer the survey. Talks about what kind of skills and resources you have that you're willing to share with others. And then other people can say, well, you know, I'd love to have this skill. So the asset survey combines those things. It's up on our website. And anybody, if I want to learn how to can or compost or scythe or sharpen tools, or I need a rototiller for a day, you know, it's all on there to share with one another. There wasn't a necessary model for that. We just thought this would be good. And then we share it with others and others can do it. So I think it's that adaptability, that it's not prescribed.
Where do people look if they want to know what these principles and guidelines are?
I think it's important to realize that social movements are different than sort of corporate franchises. And it's not like you buy a license to be a transition town. If it inspires you, the basic ideas, and a bunch of people get together and let's say, let's try to do it. At the same time, it is a network of about 1,000 communities now that are formal transition initiatives around the world. And so there are networks, there's training. And so there's a concern about quality control. There's also, you know, trainings and workshops on how to deal with difficult people. Let's face it, we're a cussed species, and sometimes the culture doesn't help us really think well about how to work with other people. And that's why transition often talks about, well, we need an outer transition of our community. We need to relocalize our economies. We need to have an energy descent plan and figure out how we're going to use forms of energy that aren't damaging the way fossil fuels are, and also learn to live on less. So those are some core concerns with the ethical things. And the basic thing is that, you know, that may be enough to sort of guide people as they work it out in their community. One of the things I like that Rob Hopkins, who wrote the Transition Handbook in 2008, he subscribes to what he calls the theory of anyway. And the theory of anyway goes, we'll say climate change doesn't turn out to be quite as serious as we thought. And say it turns out alternative energy sources are going to be just as abundant and maybe more abundant. Do you really going to feel so terrible and really bad that, oh, now we have more local democracy and now, you know, kids know how to grow food and are more self-reliant and, oh, you know, I learned how to make a cob house. My life has been ruined because of that. So part of it is that these are skills of a decent culture and life anyway. So the sense of urgency, I think, is there, but it is also appealing to people about a sense of being connected to the land and to each other.
You asked about how do you get started? Well, you can go to transitionnetwork.org, which is international, transitionus.org, which is national, and then you can go to quakersintransition.wordpress.com and find some networking of friends that are involved in this. You can buy the Transition Handbook, first published, then Transition Companion, which just was released this last year. And there are some other books. The Transition Timeline is another. So there are tools out there, very practical tools. If you are interested, you can get on the Transition US website and look for trainings, trainers. Steve is about to go get trained to be a trainer. And so we're going to have, like in New England, probably 12 trainers that would be available to do these weekends. You will find them and you'll be able to organize in your community such a training. After that, at some point, a new training now is called Transition Thrive, which is you've got your group, you've been at it for a few years. How do you go deeper? How do you go to the next level? When I visited transition communities like in Scotland, they actually were incorporated. They were doing community business. They had community bakeries. They raised the money in the community. There's actually a wonderful book called The Town That Food Saved. It's about Hardwick, Vermont, and the very creative ways that they used community funding and federal and state funding to start things that were important for that community. So they're actually in England and in Scotland, they are moving forward in that way. So that's kind of this thrive. What do we do? And the thing about governments, in a community, it's very important to partner with your town or city government. So in my community, a couple of us made an appointment, went and talked to our select board about what we were doing. We're already partnering with the Conservation Commission and the Energy Committee in the town, but we wanted to partner with the select board. And all of a sudden they said, we've got two projects for you right now, you know? And it was one about, hey, too many parents are driving their kids to school and everybody's paying for school buses. And it causes a huge traffic jam at the central school. And what can you do about that? And the other one was, help us get a recycling center that would come like once a month, you know, a transfer station kind of roving thing. And could you do that? And we were like, yes. So they gave us some real practical things to do, and they were delighted that we were willing to tackle it. So our first task is going to be, how do we make riding the bus really cool? So that kids say to their parent, no, no, don't drive me. I want to get on the bus. So
good luck on that one. Yeah, good luck. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
The other thing that you brought up, government, and you had mentioned that before, Mark, that I think there's a distinction to be made between if we wait for government, it won't happen fast enough. But that's different than saying there is no role for government in making things better. Certainly at the level of international treaties, certain national policies could help facilitate this. And so it's not an anti-government stance per se. It's just sort of we're ultimately responsible. And we can wait around for other people to do it for us. But let's just get going at the scale we can do. And that would likely, as that mushrooms and more communities are doing this and engaging in this process, it likely will capture the attention. And certainly in places where it's more advanced, it has. In Keene, one of the things we have is just an awareness building is that we have something called Transition Tuesdays. And so we have community conversations once a month or maybe some films. And we had this great film called A Convenient Truth, which is about Curitiba, Brazil, which has done some amazing things around recycling, around public transportation, affordable housing, encouraging entrepreneurship for small businesses. So what we did is we showed that movie, and because we feel that people need to see as much or more a sense of what's possible, what people are already doing, than the dire consequences if we don't do something. So we showed that, but then we brought in somebody from the city council, we brought in the city planner, and we brought somebody in from the county conservation district to talk about the ways that city and county government are already engaged in the same concerns that the transition movement has and seeing themselves as partner and telling great stories. And some of it was just simple about, you know, the solar panels on our city hall. But the city planner said, you know, once you start thinking like this about where can we find creative things, everything starts looking like an opportunity. And so he described how in the water treatment plant, water rushes in. And then all of a sudden they realized that rushing water is untapped energy. And so they put, you know, these little micro turbines that come in, and now the entire water treatment plant is off the grid. The water going into it that needs to be treated powers the whole thing.
Just a few of many possible examples of transition town thinking being implemented in the U.S. and around the world, shared thanks to Steve Chase and Rua Swinnerfelt, both active in transition town work in their respective locales of Keene, New Hampshire and Charlotte, Vermont, with both of them involved together in Quakers in Transition. That's it for Sprouts today, but you can hear the full Spirit in Action interview with Steve and Rua, including another half hour of thought, inspiration, and action related to the Transition Town movement at northernspiritradio.org. Just search for Transition Town on the site. Again, that's northernspiritradio.org. You also heard the theme music for Spirit in Action, Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country, bringing you local radio productions of national interest. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase it nationally, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Mark Helpsmeet of Northern Spirit Radio in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.